And in this hour, it reads like something out of a crime novel. A mysterious man breaks into a museum in the dead of night to make off with a valuable painting. No, make that a diamond necklace. Scratch that. Let's make it a rare artifact from the ancient world. Actually, none of the above. The actual theft we'll talk about in this hour involved stealing dead birds, and not the mounted kind looking all fierce, just bird corpses stashed in drawers in a museum in England. The robbery is the focus of the book The Feather Thief, subtitled Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. It's the work of Kirk Wallace Johnson, who has had his writing widely published in the likes of the LA Times and the New Yorker. His previous book is To Be a Friend is Fatal, and Kirk is the founder of the List Project to resettle Iraqi allies. Kirk Wallace Johnson, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So it seems your need to decompress from the Iraqi resettlement work led you to fly fishing, is that right?
Yeah. I after the better part of a decade fighting the U.S. government on behalf of thousands of Iraqis that had risked their lives to help us during the war as interpreters, I realized that just at the rate things were going, I was going to be doing this for the rest of my life, and that felt kind of overwhelming. And the only kind of peace and quiet that I ever found was when I went fly fishing, because you get up into these mountain streams and your cell phone signal disappears, and the only thing that really matters at that point is how quiet you are, how observant you are to the way that the current's breaking over a boulder or the life cycle of aquatic insects. And I became kind of addicted to it, to be blunt. And it was during one of these outings in the northern part of New Mexico that the guide that I had hired for the day to kind of teach me that river just mentioned casually the story in the fly fishing, fly tying world about an American kid that broke into the British Museum, stole hundreds of exotic birds, sold them to this kind of underground community of Victorian salmon fly tires in order to buy a new golden flute. And as soon as he said this, I was just, you know, little plumes of smoke came out of my ears. I was like, what in the world? This can't be true.
Yeah, because you have so many different realms of crossover there. I mean, the fly tires and the Victorian fly tires and the golden flute. I mean, there's so many different directions to go here.
I know. And for me, I felt like no one could hear that sentence without like wanting to know more. And that's really what set me off, and that was nearly 7 years ago.
Wow, so it's been a long process. Just to give people an idea of what was sought in the museum heist, I mean, some of Darwin's own specimens are there, is that right? But they were passed over?
Yeah, all of Darwin's finches are kept in this museum. This is basically the second largest ornithological collection on the face of the planet. There are 750,000 birds that are gathered over hundreds of years. And, you know, as you indicated, these are not like what you see when you go into a public part of a museum. Their wings are pulled tight against their body so that they can be stored in thousands of cabinets and drawers. And they're used for research, because if you have a bird from 1820 in the same species from 1890 and the same one from 1950, that enables scientists to make all kinds of inferences by comparing those specimens. And they come from all over the world, and it's just that for this community of sort of fly-tying fanatics, there's a certain number of these species that have just skyrocketed in value because they're so hard to get now.
So even though we're talking about Darwin specimens nearby, they just weren't colorful enough to be picked up by the
exactly.
Feather.
Exactly. And, you know, he also, so, I mean, and I'm sure Darwin's birds could have sold for a fortune if he found the right buyer, but the museum also owns a copy of Audubon's Birds of America, one of the original editions, which I think the last auction for that book went for $13 million, and,
wow.
And he walked right past that in order to get to the real quarry, which were these really brightly colored, beautiful birds from New Guinea, the birds of paradise, and then from Central and South America, the birds in the Katinga family.
So, Kirk, when we're talking about the thief here, I mean, Edwin Rist was no street crook. Who is this guy?
he's a fascinating person. He is a virtuoso flautist, started at a very young age, who was living in London at the time as a student at the Royal Academy of Music, which is, you know, one of the most prestigious institutions in the world. But at the same time as he was mastering the flute, he also encountered the art of fly tying. And it started when he was 10 years old. He saw a video of a trout fly being tied. And I imagine your listeners in Southern Oregon and Northern California will recognize that trout fly is not a beautiful thing. It's just made to mimic the insects that are in the river at that point in their life cycle. But a salmon fly is a completely different beast. These are really beautiful works of art. A single fly might have 10 or 15 different species of feathers, and they're married in these really intricate patterns, and there's an anatomy to these flies. There are cheeks, there are wings, there's a tail. But the thing is that there's no biology behind it. There's no salmon aren't hungry when they're spawning. They're not.
Oh, that's
right. No reason why a salmon should care about a bird of paradise feather, but here we are.
Here we are indeed. And the book is called The Feather Thief, Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. 299 bird corpses from the British Natural History Museum at Tring outside London. We'll come back and talk more with Kirk Wallace Johnson about the theft and the reasons behind it and some world you might never have even thought about existing that we'll explore when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to the journalist and author Kirk Wallace Johnson. His previous book is called To Be a Friend is Fatal, which led him to start the List Project to resettle Iraqi allies who'd helped us in Iraq. He needed to decompress from that work, and he took up fly fishing, and that's when he heard about the story of a guy who stole 299 bird corpses from the British Natural History Museum at Tring outside London, a story that Kirk went on to tell in the book The Feather Thief, Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. Questions and comments from you are welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So here's where we start getting into this wild and unimaginable feather underground, as you describe it. How deep and wide is this culture, Kirk?
Well, they're not really happy with my use of that phrase, but there is a cohort of men that's almost entirely men. I'm trying to think of a woman that does this. They're all over the world, but mostly in the U.S., Northern Europe, Scandinavia, and then some scattered elsewhere. And they follow these 19th century texts that almost with a kind of religious adherence to the recipes and the rules of fly tying. And so if you look at these books from 1848 and 1890, they'll say, if you're going to tie a Jock Scott fly or the Durham Ranger or these other kind of fancy sounding things, you have to use one feather from this bird from Brazil, and you have to use one feather from this bird from British Guiana, and it's a snapshot in a way of a world that doesn't really exist anymore. In that many of the birds that these guys were using back then are now protected species.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a great status in being able to tie these things. One of these flies called the Chatterer requires so many rare feathers that it would cost about $2,000 in order to tie one of them.
Which raises the question, are tied flies from the Victorian era like this, are they worth a lot of money? Were they ever even used for fishing, for that matter?
Back then, they were used for fishing, but the feathers weren't worth as much back then, obviously, but this was sort of the province of these British aristocrats who had private rivers, and they had clubs that they would hang out in, and they would come up with these flies that they declared were the best for each river, except you could catch salmon with with dog fur on a fly. There's no there's no reason for any of this. It's just you know, fancy guys trying to flaunt their status.
Wow, status.
Most of the guys now, like, they don't even know how to fish. They don't have fly rods and reels. They didn't. This is just an aesthetic obsession for them.
So you mentioned that there's a different purpose for the trout fly is supposed to mimic a bug in the river. Salmon aren't eating when they get to the point in the river where they're getting caught because they're about to spawn. So is the idea just to catch the salmon's eye and do the whole, like, get out of the way of my eggs thing?
Yeah, it's really to just drift something in front of them and hope that they strike out of aggression. And the books from this period preach a kind of pseudoscience that, you know, if you have, a, you know, this particular species, the subspecies is better because it's a slightly paler shade of blue, but it's nonsense. We know that salmon's eyesight essentially switches to infrared when they're spawning. You don't have to be an advanced biologist to understand that a salmon in Scotland will never develop a natural preference for a feather from the king bird of paradise from the highlands of New Guinea. Those two creatures are never going to meet each other.
Very true. So let's go back to where these feathers came from that were worth, in the mind of Edwin Rist, stealing from the museum at Tring. And there's a great history that you give here. So let's go back to Darwin's day and talk about Alfred Russel Wallace. And wow, was this guy a hard luck story or what?
What an extraordinary man. And I was just in England, and I had the great honor of meeting his 94-year-old grandson.
Wow.
Who showed me a number of Wallace's relics. But Wallace, I've always thought if Americans got a chance to meet this guy, they would embrace him immediately. He's the classic underdog. He was a self-taught naturalist. He was pulled from school after, you know, only about 8 years of formal education. But he was inspired by Darwin's Voyage of the Beagle, and he wanted to become a naturalist, and he also wanted to tackle the question that was bedeviling everyone at the time, which was why do some species die? What's the origin of species? No one had an answer yet. Darwin hadn't published anything yet. And Wallace spent 4 years of his life in Brazil gathering specimens against impossible odds, you know, 10,000 birds, tens of thousands of beetles and fish and plants. And he loaded them all up on his ship, and he was going to return to England really with a lifelong collection that he could make his career off of. And 2 weeks into the trip, the ship caught on fire, and he barely escaped with the shirt on his back. He grabbed a sextant and a pocket watch and a couple other things, but his entire collection went up in smoke. But rather than being defeated by this, he kind of, you know, brushed the dust off, and over the next year he published a ton of articles, he wrote some books, and basically set back out, this time to the Malay Archipelago, and while he was there gathering hundreds of thousands of specimens, he on his own figured out evolution through natural selection in the middle of a malarial fever, and when the fever broke, he sat down and he wrote a paper, and he mailed it to Charles Darwin. And Darwin is, of course, famous the world over, and I'm not suggesting Darwin stole it, but this is one of the most extraordinary moments in the history of science, is that these two men independently figured it out at the same time. But Wallace was just sort of, in my opinion, passed over by the establishment. But it was Wallace's birds that ended up at the Tring, at this museum, and he wrote very eloquently about why we need to preserve these specimens, that they hold answers to questions that we haven't even thought to ask yet. And over generations, the British curators went to great lengths. I mean, these specimens survived World War I when Zeppelins drifted over London and dropped hundreds of thousands of thermite bombs. They were evacuated under cover of night from the Luftwaffe, from Hitler's Luftwaffe during the Blitz. And they were evacuated to this small museum. It's just nobody... When they were there, everyone thought that they were safe, and no one realized that the ultimate threat would come from a fly tire.
Which it really did, which is the subject of the book, The Feather Thief, that we're talking to Kirk Wallace Johnson about. The book is subtitled Beauty, Obsession, and the natural history heist of the century, where Edwin Rist made off with 299 bird corpses from the museum at Tring. There's another, we move on from Alfred Russel Wallace, who despite all his hard times lived to be 90 years old and got to publish a lot of stuff and is revered in, not as widely obviously as Darwin, but there's another name we know in here, Rothschild. It's a family name we know anyway. What is Walter Rothschild's part of this story?
So Walter Rothschild is another lovable character, but he was kind of the black sheep of his family. He was born into what some historians have said is the most wealthy family in the history of the planet. But he could care less about banking. He hated the Rothschild's business. All he wanted to do was collect bird specimens and beetles and other things. When he was 8 years old, he said, he wants a museum for his birthday to be built for him. And sure enough, for his 21st birthday, that he was given his own museum in the corner of the Rothschild estate at Tring Park. And he built the largest private collection known to man until it was, you know, there was a kind of wild story, but he had an affair and was blackmailed, and he paid the blackmailer's fee by selling off the bulk of his bird collection to the American Museum of Natural History in New York, and that's how they got their collection, essentially.
Oh, wow. So an affair led to the collection of the American Museum of Natural History.
Exactly. And with Rothschild, when Rothschild died, he bequeathed his museum to the British Museum, and that's how it became the site of, you know, essentially the scene of the crime here.
We're talking again to Kirk Wallace Johnson about his book, The Feather Thief, Beauty Obsession and the Natural History Heist of the Century. You can join the conversation on The Exchange. Many questions, because every time we ask one, we seem to get an answer that leads us in five more directions. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. Send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So the collection of these birds at the time of Alfred Russel Wallace and others, I mean, the bird species populations themselves were heading down in a lot of places. Was it the scientific collectors that were having this impact?
No. In fact, it's a kind of popular misperception that scientists have led to any kind of species decline. The real reason for the collapse of so many of these species in that century was for women's fashion. Marie Antoinette put a diamond-encrusted egret plume into her hair and set off a global frenzy that became known as the feather fever, where women were competing to display their own status by wearing entire stuffed birds of paradise and their hats and other species. And historians have said that this is the single greatest direct extermination of wildlife in the history of the planet was for women's fashion. And the numbers are staggering. I mean, we're talking about tens of thousands of tons of plumage that were passing through the port of London, New York, in France every year. There were 100,000 New Yorkers employed just in the hat-making business in 1900. But really, I mean, to me, what was fascinating, and I get into this in the book, is that it was women that led the charge for reform. Through the Audubon Society and the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, it was women that eventually stigmatized the wearing of feathers for fashion and also agitated for the first wildlife refuges and conservation laws. I mean, this whole crazy story is what gave us the modern conservation movement.
And I can see why it took up 10 years of your life, because every time you unfolded another corner of the story, you ended up in what essentially was another book, another set of books.
Yeah, it was a real challenge. The initial manuscript, I think, was around 140,000 words, which is almost double the book that you have in your hand there. So there were a lot of painful cuts that were made, but all for the best, I guess.
Well, I was going to ask what the big deal was about the bird of paradise, but as I flip open to the color plates in the book, there's a picture of an adult male greater bird of paradise. This is quite a spectacular bird.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why they're called that and why these birds have just really kind of occupied a singular perch in the public imagination. If people haven't seen the Birds of Paradise, just get on YouTube and you'll find these amazing David Attenborough narrated clips. But these are unlike anything you've ever seen on the planet. They're stunning. They have feathers that don't even look possible. That for a long time before they were brought to the West as bird skins, the belief was that they were so strange that they must actually not be of the planet, that they must live in the heavens and feed on ambrosia, and they would hatch their eggs while they were in flight, and they were kind of magical creatures, and that's, I think, why they've always beckoned people.
That's amazing. And there's a picture of a woman wearing an entire bird of paradise on a hat around 1900 in the book, and you just get an idea of why the bird populations crashed. And so did many go extinct because of the hats?
I can't think of any that went into extinction, but certainly there were plenty that went onto the endangered, what became the endangered species list. The head of the Audubon Society, I'm paraphrasing, but he said something to the effect that the species that fashion selects is doomed, that one season would change and all of a sudden the new bird would be, you know, the red kite or, you know, a lesser bird of paradise or whatever, and all of a sudden the hunters would go meet that demand and that population would precipitously decline.
Wow. So at some point restrictions came into effect and this trade was squelched. And you mentioned that women had a lot to do with that through the Audubon Society and through developing wildlife preserves and all of the things that we know today, where we give birds a place to go and not be molested by people. But so then I'm curious about the resurgence then of this interest in the Victorian salmon fly stuff, because the seminal book was in 1895. So we're well past that time.
Yeah. So there, I think, you know, are you referring to the resurgence today now in the 21st century?
Mm-hmm.
I think the internet had a big role in that, and that there were these little pockets of practitioners of this art form that were, you know, they practiced in obscurity. But then once the internet came, once eBay came, once these forums came where they could congregate, they all found each other. And the marketplace found them. And so in the early days of eBay, there was kind of a gold rush for, you know, people finding these old hats in their grandma's attic and selling them off, and the fly tires would snatch them up. But there are only so many times that, you know, there are only so many hats in granny's attic at this point.
Right.
But really, the internet was a huge part in the sort of the modern resurgence, and they all congregate on a few forums and now in private Facebook groups where they show off their latest fly, and a single one of these flies could take 10-15 hours to tie, and they'll ask each other for techniques and tips and materials, and they'll trade and buy and sell with each other. But this is a subculture that is defined by scarcity. That they know there are so many of these flies that few people have ever tied because they require so many hard-to-get feathers. And so the whole community is driven by a sense of longing for the raw materials, so to speak.
Oh, so are they trading single feathers, things like that, on eBay?
Yeah, in some cases. I just saw one today where a guy was offering up, he was just as a present going to give a single scarlet macaw tail feather, I think, and there were all these people saying, please let me be the one that gets it. But they also just have a really active, you know, commercial side to these sites where you can right now, you can go on eBay and buy two resplendent quetzal feathers, which is an endangered species. It's totally illegal to buy and sell these things, but eBay doesn't care, and you can buy a pair of them for, you know, if they're from the right part of the bird, two feathers will go for $100.
Wow. So did Edwin Rist was doing the fly tying. He never did the fishing, though, I gather. Did
no.
He? No, okay.
No.
So, but I can just imagine that he's thinking, wow, I can, you know, if I'm getting $100 for two feathers from an endangered species, think what I could get for almost 300 birds worth of feathers.
I mean, one of the estimates is that we're talking about it, like around $1 million worth of birds here. And he, you know, it took me about 4 years to get him to agree to an interview, but he described the moment of when he first walked into the museum, into the collection, as being almost like being in the heart of Fort Knox, that there's just so much gold that your brain fails to compute, like it shuts down almost. And when he was surrounded by all these birds and he realized the monetary value, he did everything he could to find a way to get back there to end up stealing them.
Which he did indeed do. The book is called The Feather Thief, Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century, a story with so many twists and turns that we've discovered so far. We'll come back and talk more with the author, Kirk Wallace Johnson, and if you'd like to join us by phone or email, you are welcome too. The Jefferson Exchange returns on JPR in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Our guest is Kirk Wallace Johnson, journalist, author, founder of the List Project to resettle Iraqi allies. He took up fly fishing and on a fly fishing trip learned about the theft of 299 bird corpses, rare bird corpses, from a museum outside London, which led to his writing the book, The Feather Thief, Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. You were talking about actually meeting Edwin Rist. He did agree to an interview with you. Is that the only one he's given so far since the theft?
Yeah, to my knowledge. And I don't know of anyone who's landed one with him since.
Wow. So here he is standing in the museum on his first trip there, and he realizes this is like Fort Knox. There's so much value here, which he knew because he was getting into the Victorian salmon fly tying. How much thought did he put into what it might take to be able to sell these off bit by bit over the years? Because it would take years, wouldn't it?
I think actually the demand for these is so intense, and because he was so intricately a part of this community, he was actually hailed as the future of fly tying by Fly Tire magazine, which I actually subscribe to now improbably, but and so he knew there was an insatiable demand for the product, and all he had to do was just sort of spring the product loose from the museum and he would have no difficulty selling. The demand was so intense that we're talking the British authorities put it at, I think, a few hundred thousand dollars in a conservative accounting. There was an American dentist from the Pacific Northwest that boarded a plane to London just to buy directly from him. The hard part was getting the things out. And he spent, he initially entered the museum under false pretenses to case the place, essentially. He was taking photographs of the hallways and the entry and exit points. And it took him about 7 months of plotting, during which time he bought thousands of little Ziploc bags that he would eventually use to sell the things. He bought a diamond blade glass cutter, wire cutters, and plotted out his eventual heist. He even created a Word document called Plan for Museum Invasion .doc. Can't make it up.
Yeah,
and,
really.
And he did it. He pulled it off. He climbed a 7-foot wall behind the museum, broke out the window, was in there for a couple hours just having his pick at the birds. And he did miss his last train back to London, so he spent the night at the train station right near the museum with about $1 million of dead birds in his suitcase and kind of nervously hoping that no one would find him or ask him what was inside. But it then took 15 months for the law to catch up with them, and during that time, he sold a lot of these things.
So the first part of this is why did the museum have some kind of a system that would have noticed that there was something amiss? There was a broken window, because he dropped his glass cutter, didn't he? Had to use a rock?
He did, yeah. The museum was very reluctant to talk to me, but I did manage to get a lot out of them, but they did admit that an alarm had been triggered in a different part of the museum, that the security guard on shift then did not notice. And so the following morning, when the guard was doing his rounds, he found the broken window. And they nervously ran to check to make sure that nobody had stolen Darwin's birds. Sadly enough, no one checked to see if Wallace's birds had been stolen.
That's the amazing part to me, is that they're going through drawer after drawer of the Darwin birds, going, whew, everything's here. Everything's here.
Yes. Yeah, and essentially they did a cursory check, and they called it a closed case, that they thought it might have been somebody trying to just steal phones or laptops and popped in and didn't find anything and left. And it wasn't until about 5 or 6 weeks later that they just by chance happened to open up a drawer as part of a research request, and the drawer was empty, and then they pulled out the drawer below it, and that was empty, and then their kind of hearts sank as they realized that they had actually been victims to a huge heist.
So months later, they figured this out.
I think it was just short of 2 months later.
Just short of 2 months, okay. So oddly enough, they knew about the interest in feathers, and they had made some changes at Tring. Like what?
They had recognized that theft was an increasing concern. And so with some species, they had more of the extinct specimens. Like I think they have a skeleton of a dodo and a great auk and these other things. A number of their specimens they had locked up and secured, but they had not done it with these specimens. And they were really caught off guard because they did not realize that these specimens that were stolen, the species had become so astronomically valuable to the fly tying community.
That is just amazing. We're still talking some space involved here. I mean, 299 bird bodies is still a lot. And he made off with them in a single suitcase. Is that right?
Yeah. You keep hitting the exact points, which I've gone back and forth in my mind hundreds of times, but 299 birds. The largest ones were the resplendent quetzals, which are about 4 feet long from beak to tail, but he managed to steal 39 of those by tightly, patiently coiling the tails up and then sort of depositing them in his suitcase. Around 100 of the birds that he stole were Katingas, which are these brilliant turquoise, sort of cerulean blue birds from Central and Southern America. And those are about the size of, they could fit in the palm of your hand. But we went back and forth, my wife and I, in the end, we resorted to taking our laundry and rolling up socks and T-shirts to try to approximate the size of each species. Because oddly enough, all the museums I approached wouldn't let me come and try to jam all of their birds into suitcases to test this. Our verdict, and I have talked with a number of ornithologists, and they said it would be tight, but it would be possible. But there always is a little part of me that wonders if there was someone else there that night.
Really? So Rist wouldn't admit to having an accomplice then, huh?
No. He did have an accomplice that I eventually uncovered, who helped him with the sales of these specimens. I mean, he essentially set up one of his friends as a fence, I think, in order to draw some attention away from him. I'll never know with certainty whether or not there was someone else there that night, because the closed the CCTV footage expires usually after 28 days, and I think they found out 35 days afterwards. So the footage had all expired by that point.
So did the fact that, I mean, once they discovered the birds missing, did they then go to the logical places, like to go online and look for places that had perhaps an upswing in the quantity of bird feathers available for sale?
One would think, but the answer to that is it certainly doesn't seem so. This is, to me, the really just crazy, infuriating part to this whole thing. I think the British Museum was so embarrassed by this theft that they almost, buried their heads in the sand and did whatever they could to avoid dealing with it. the feather thief had actually signed his name into their guest book, 7 months before the heist. And I've seen the guest book. This is a small town museum. It's not
not
like
digital.
Thousands of pages long. Mm-hmm. And he was, so they had the thief's signature and name in their site. They had him emailing them about these species. And if you went to edwinrist.com in those days, you would have seen a one-for-one match of their missing birds being sold with the Latin names being used. I mean, this was all happening very flagrantly, and I don't know how on earth they missed this. In the end, he was caught because of another fly tire who happened to be a detective in the police service of Northern Ireland, who was not assigned this case. He just happened to be a fly tire who took up the hobby as a way to kind of keep sane during these 15-hour stakeouts during the Troubles. And that detective was at a fly tying festival in Holland, and he saw some of these birds that looked suspiciously like museum birds, and he's the one that started asking some questions and eventually called in the tip that led to his arrest.
And I understand that when the police got to Rist's apartment, he folded right away.
Exactly. He pointed to a television that he had also stolen from the student dorm. I think his sort of his guilt maybe just took over at that point. But the important thing is that of the 299 birds that they found, about 100 were recovered in perfect condition. They had the tags still attached to them, mm-hmm. meaning that they can be used for research. Roughly 170 to 100 were recovered without the tags, which is a real problem because the birds are so identical looking that even the most trained ornithologists and curators can't tell if this one was the one from 1820 or if that one's the one from 1850.
Oh. So even though they're back, the evolutionary record is disturbed.
Exactly. And it puts all kinds of things into question. And then a third of the birds were missing. But because he admitted his guilt right at the outset, it's a kind of nature of the justice system, but the investigation stops at that point and it goes directly to sentencing. And so as soon as he said, yeah, it was me, everyone stopped looking for the missing birds. The museum, I think, was happy to say, well, we found the guy. We're pleased the matter is resolved, I think is what the director of the museum said. And so by the time I heard about this, it was done. It was a case closed. It was a thing of the past. There was very little that had been written about it, except that hundreds of thousands of birds were still floating around out there, and I could see them being trafficked in the forums, and I could see what looked like them. And no one was looking for them. And so I just thought this was insane, and I started building my own timeline of the crime, and I didn't really know what I was doing. I just was gathering evidence. And eventually people started talking to me, and I started flipping other people, and before long I had the full picture of the crime.
So in addition, so Edwin Rist, did he get a very short sentence? Is that why he was available to be interviewed by you?
He got a suspended sentence, which means he never spent a night behind bars for this crime.
Wow.
He managed to do this because he had a prestigious psychologist who gave him a diagnosis of Asperger's. I have nothing against Asperger's. I think I have people in my extended family who have it, so there's nothing, no part of me that doubts its existence. But in this case, I think it was at maybe the six-hour marker of my interview with the feather thief. I said to him, I said, you know, I don't want to sound like a jerk, but you don't seem like you have Asperger's. You're making eye contact. You're reading the very subtle subtext of some of these questions. And he smiled and he goes, well, you know, and this is paraphrasing, but he said something to the effect that he essentially became what he needed to become at that point in his life. And he said he never had a problem with eye contact before or since. It's just during that time, all of a sudden he realized he couldn't look at anyone's eyes. And then he started rocking back and forth in front of me and rubbing his hand on his leg. And essentially, to me, suggesting that he had gamed the whole thing. And I confronted the psychologist, and he admitted that, yes, it could be faked, but you'd hope that an expert would figure this out. But
so is he persona non grata among orchestras now, or perhaps the opposite? Are people, you know, bringing him in to play flute concertos because he's the feather thief?
He's performing under a different name. I didn't feel like it was my place to identify that name, but no, astonishingly, he was, even after all of this, I mean, the director of the museum described this to the courts as a catastrophic theft from humanity. Some of the species that he stole 17 flame bowerbirds. There are something like 25 flame bowerbirds in all of the museums in the world.
Wow.
They're never going to be returned. That's just lost. There's a huge hole in the scientific record. And astonishingly, after all of that, the Royal Academy of Music still gave him a degree, and he's performing all over the place now.
Wow. So that is the story of Edwin Rist, who is the title character in The Feather Thief, Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. We've got a lot of detail in here, but there's so much more that the book holds that we didn't even get to. Kirk Wallace Johnson, the author of the book, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.